The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, I'm Georgine Rice. This week, over 3 million Uyghur Muslims in concentration camps, a co-owner of the Golden State Warriors made a candid admission.
Nobody cares about what's happening to the Uyghurs, okay?
We'll get analysis from Gordon Chang.
These are statements that no one should make.
And Albert Mohler.
It is morally deplorable not to confront genocide when it is taking place right before our eyes.
Plus, we'll look at the growth of the church beyond our borders.
Christianity is spreading rapidly into these former countries that were strongholds for other false religions,
including in places facing serious persecution.
Persecution doesn't seem to stop the growth of the church. In fact, it's just the opposite.
All this and more. I'm Georgine Rice. I'm glad to be with you once again. I'm coming to you from Portland and my home station of KPDQ. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon at 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. We'll begin with comments made by venture capitalist Chima Pahalapichia. Originally from Sri Lanka, he's a Bay Area billionaire who is on the ownership team of the Golden State Warriors, the NBA team with three championships in the last decade. So what brings Chima Pahalapichia to our attention? Well, the astonishing comments he made on his All In podcast regarding the human rights atrocities suffered by the Uyghur population in China. There are some 380 facilities detaining somewhere around 3 million Muslim Uyghurs. They are essentially 21st century concentration camps. And Pahalapichia, one of the owners of an NBA team, weighed in on the subject during an all-in podcast he co-hosts.
Nobody cares about what's happening to the Uyghurs, okay? You bring it up because you really
what?
Care. And I think
what
that's
do you mean,
nice that you
cares?
Care. The rest of us don't care. I'm just
well,
telling you a
care?
Very hard...
Wait, wait,
I'm
you're saying you
very,
personally don't care?
I'm telling you a very hard, ugly truth, okay? Of all the things that I care about, yes, it is below my line, okay? Of all the things that I care about... It is below my line.
Disappointing.
Well, I think people, if you explain to them what's happening to the Uyghurs in China, they care, but it's not top of mind for them.
That's not
what's
caring.
Top of mind right now is they go to their grocery store and the shelves are empty.
Sure. That I care yeah. about. Yeah. I care about the fact that our economy could turn on a dime if China invades Taiwan. I care about that. I care about climate change. You know, I care about I care about America's crippling and, you know, decrepit healthcare infrastructure. But if you're asking me, do I care about a segment of a class of people in another country? Not until we can take care of ourselves will I prioritize them over us. And I think a lot of people believe that. And I'm sorry if that's a hard truth to hear. But every time I say that I care about the Uyghurs, I'm really just lying if I don't really care. And so I'd rather not lie to you and tell you the truth. It's not a priority for me.
It was that portion that caught the attention of media outlets. Sadly, Pahalapichia's most revealing comments were as he continued.
So again, I'm not even sure that China is a dictatorship the way that you want to call it that. Again, I think
communist country that's in the name.
Look, you have to understand, Jason, there are a set of checks and balances here on China that, you know, at the end of the day, I don't think that I have the moral absolutism to judge China. And I would say that when NATO is silent, the United Nations is silent, all of Western Europe is silent, and America is effectively silent, that this issue may be small data points being extrapolated in a way to create a narrative that maybe not be true. And if it is true, Jason, there's a responsibility for those body politics to do something because that is the early warning signal that the rest of the world uses to say, okay, hold on, let me reprioritize my list of things. So,
yeah, so
I guess what
view-
I'm saying is I am not going to be an armchair journalist on this topic, nor am I going to be the armchair human rights advocate for the world because I just don't know. I can focus on the things that I know about, build the things that I know about. And if something really does get red light status, then other parties will do something. And again, I just want to be clear. NATO is silent. United Nations is silent. America is silent. A press release doesn't change the actual technical posture on these topics.
Okay. If your position is that human rights matters to you if government, large government organizations or politicians give you the green light to care about it, that's fine. I care about it intrinsically every day.
Great. I'm fine with you doing that.
Kevin McCullough, my colleague in New York City on AM 570 The Mission, turned to China expert Gordon Chang.
The partial owner of the Golden State Warriors came out basically giving the implication that nobody cares about the Uyghurs in China. Now, I will tell you that if you ask 15 people on the street here in New York City if they even know what the Uyghurs are, there's a very high likelihood that only a handful of them would, if any at all. But that doesn't preclude the owner of an NBA team from making such a kind of calloused and uncaring statement, does it?
He said that nobody cares about the Uyghurs, which isn't true. But he also said some other things which have yet to really get wide publicity, and that is that America is no better than China, that the genocide may be not occurring, and that the Chinese are not running a dictatorship. So these things are highly questionable, as you might imagine.
Those sound like straight out of Beijing CCP talking points. I mean, you couldn't have nailed it any better.
He was very close to what the Communist Party was saying. What's really surprising, though, is that he is, and his family is, a refugee from Sri Lanka, where there was ethnic cleansing, where there was genocide. So these are statements that no one should make, but certainly nobody with his background should be making. And this just shows you that the woke left, they're hypocritical at best, but at worst what they're doing is they are supporting crimes against humanity, which is what Chamath was saying.
Let me ask you just as a general question. The NBA seems to be playing very, very tight with the CCP. What would you like to see the government do as a way of getting involved, or maybe not, to discourage the NBA from going down that path? Because this is not new in 2022. They had problems in 2021 and 2020 and 2019.
The President of the United States should invoke the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977 and prohibit the NBA and other American sporting organizations from doing business in China.
What we heard spoken out loud on this All In podcast is really just the verbal expression of what we've seen worked out by the NBA and others over the past decade. Albert Mohler takes a closer look at Pahalapichia's statement and the lucrative relationship between the NBA and the People's Republic of China from his Briefing podcast.
What we are looking at here is one of the darkest statements made by anyone in public or private life that has come to light in a very long time. We just remind ourselves that the Chinese Communist Party has tried to wipe out the Uyghur people. Genocide, legally defined, is exactly the right word here. Uyghur communities have been destroyed. Uyghur families have been divided. There are Uyghurs who have been sent and are being sent right now to concentration camps, just like in Nazi Germany. We also face the truth that the Chinese Communist Party is using the most draconian means even to try to prevent the Uyghur people from reproducing and having children. This is a dark moment. It is one of the darkest moments thus far in the 21st century. And here you have a major investor who has a 10% stake in the NBA team, the Golden State Warriors. He says this concern is beneath his level of concern, below his moral bottom line. He doesn't care. What's really going on here is the effort of so many people and the NBA here, not a coincidence. So many people to say, we're not going to pull back a bit in doing lucrative business with the People's Republic of China because, after all, we're making money. Who cares about the morality? This investor said that he believed concern for human rights was a so-called luxury belief. And then he turned to the United States. He said, so until we actually clean up our own house, the idea that we step outside of our borders with, you know, the us sort of like morally virtue signaling about somebody else's human rights track record is deplorable, end quote. Now, here's what I want us to know. Let's just stop for a moment and look at the language. One of the issues that we discuss regularly on the briefing is that to be human is to make moral judgments continuously, inevitably. And that's because at least a part of what it means that we are made in God's image is that we're moral creatures. We just can't help making moral judgments. Now, notice that this particular billionaire born in Sri Lanka, holding citizenship in Canada, Canada and in the United States. He says that this issue is beneath his moral concern. But he uses language like deplorable. But what he says is deplorable, that is, something that should be absolutely denounced morally, is people in the United States or in the West telling China that it should not commit genocide against a beleaguered religious minority there. Now, if human beings learned anything, and by the way, human beings don't learn anything very well for long, but if human beings learned anything from the 20th century, it should be that it is morally deplorable not to confront genocide when it is taking place right before our eyes. Need we remind ourselves of the killing fields of Cambodia, of the concentration and the extermination camps of Nazi Germany? But here you see how money works. So often, big money is not going to be stopped by the moral concerns of what's going on in China. As I said, the National Basketball Association, he's a 10% owner of a major team. Let's just say that, the Golden State Warriors. And just last year, when a player for the Boston Celtics referred to Chinese President Xi Jinping as a brutal dictator and made other comments, China responded by threatening the future of the NBA there in China. Back a few months ago, CNN reported that China at the present makes up at least 10% of the NBA's revenue of about $8 billion. So you can do the math, 10% of $8 billion. That is now represented by China. And furthermore, China has a major investment in so many American enterprises, whether it is known or unknown, public or shadow. And the reality is that the Chinese market means that there are many who, in the name of profit and in the name of business expansion, and even in the name of saying it's deplorable to make moral judgments, they simply wash their hands and say, we'll do business with China. And we saw that the very same instinct took place in American businessmen and Western businesses doing business with the Bolsheviks after that revolution in the Soviet Union in 1917, doing business with other deplorable regimes, most importantly, doing business with Nazi Germany. And there were many American firms that were caught with great embarrassment, but not enough embarrassment, when it was discovered that they were doing business with Nazi Germany long after it was known that Nazi Germany was an evil totalitarian killing regime. But just to remind ourselves of what is at stake here, just in conclusion, let me go back to the statements made by Chamath Palihapitiya. And what he said is so chilling, I want you to hear it again. In response in this interview to a question about the genocide of the Uyghurs, this investor comes back to say, but if you're asking me, do I care about a segment of a class of people in another country? Not until we can take care of ourselves will I prioritize them over us. End quote. And this statement is made by a native of Sri Lanka who now lives in Canada and the United States in such safety. He makes this comment as genocide is being carried out against the Uyghur people in China. About this genocide, he says, quote, yes, it's below my line, meaning the line that deserves his attention. Okay. Christians are reminded that the scripture tells us that we will one day give an answer for every deed, for everything we have done, and for every word, even every idle word, much less premeditated words.
Coming up, the church is flourishing around the world.
Christianity is spreading rapidly into these former countries that were strongholds for other false religions.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. The pace and the negativity of the news cycle can be, well, overwhelming. If you're like an ever-growing percentage of the population, social media in its various forms is a key source for news and information, and how we sort through the news. It's not surprising that social media is leaving more and more Americans depressed. Gregory Jantz, author of Social Media and Depression, How to Be Healthy and Happy in the Digital Age, joined my colleague here in the Pacific Northwest, Tim Gatos from AM 820, The Word in Seattle.
It may be a big wake-up call for those of us here in the Christian West, whether we're talking about Europe or North America, that we kind of think that we're sort of the standard bearer, the paradigm setter for what evangelicalism or evangelism rather ought to look like. And certainly while, you know, we've played a significant role down through the years, God has been doing some exciting things in some exciting ways that are maybe perhaps by Western standards, a little bit out of the norm, and yet very much within his norm.
Well, it was 100 years ago that 90% of followers of Jesus lived in North America or Europe, and those numbers have almost reversed in the last 100 years. We're now about 70% of believers live outside of the North America and Europe. They're in Africa, where the church is growing fantastically, in Asia and Latin America. And now many of those countries are sending missionaries back to North America to some of the immigrants that have come into our country from these other countries. And the top mission-sending country in the world is Brazil. The second most mission-sending country is Korea. So we're seeing kind of the reverse flow of missionary activity coming back to this country. And as our country becomes more and more secular and materialistic, we're seeing God working in previously unreached places of the world.
Let's talk about how that paradigm shift has taken place. I mean, there's always kind of been a pattern to the way we have engaged in outreach and evangelism. I think, for example, of some of the history of HCJB and kind of taking the approach of going into all the world and preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. In the case of this, using radio as a means to most effectively across those borders and accomplish all of that. And yet today, even as much as we've seen a changing face of what evangelical Christianity looks like around the globe, even the ministry of, now Reach Beyond, formerly HCJB, that's even changed a bit too, hasn't it?
Well, our strategy is much different, where we used to be very Ecuador-centric, Quito-centric, and we brought missionaries in from all over the world to go to Quito and then use shortwave broadcasting to send the message to places like Europe, Russia, Africa, Asia. Today, the strategy is much more working with local partners, training indigenous people that know the language and know the culture. Most everything we do at Reach Beyond today is through a local partner. And because they're already there and they can live on $100 a month, which is the average salary, and because they already know the language and the culture, they don't have to go to language school. They don't have to take 10 years to learn the culture. And with the right equipment and the right training, they can reach their peers with the gospel of Christ. Even as we speak, we have a team over in the most populous Muslim country in the world, in Indonesia, and they're training about 28 young media professionals on how to own and run and manage a radio station. And when we leave, those 28 newly trained leaders will be reaching their countrymen. And those stations are seeing an average of 3 to 5 people a day come to Christ at each of their stations. And churches are being planted throughout Indonesia. And former Muslims are leading other Muslims to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. And it's an amazing thing that is happening as Christianity is spreading rapidly into these former countries that were strongholds for other false religions.
And I would wonder what the likes of a Hudson Taylor, who was so responsible in the 1800s for bringing the gospel to China, would think of the indigenous church in China today that is largely all run by nationals. I mean, we know that there are certainly no missionary schools there. There are no seminaries there. And yet it's one of the fastest growing churches on planet Earth, and it's all being done at the hands of nationals.
Isn't it interesting, Craig, how, I mean, it's always been true, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And some of the fastest growing spread of Christianity in the world are in countries where there is persecution. And one outstanding example is Iran, where 25 years ago, they could identify only about 400 believers. And today, and largely through social media, plus broadcasting the gospel from outside of the country with medium wave, there are hundreds of thousands of Christians, and Iran is the fastest growing Christian country in the world, percentage-wise. And some of the stand countries where there's heavy persecution, the church is multiplying in fantastic ways. So persecution doesn't seem to stop the growth of the church. In fact, it's just the opposite, where there is opposition in places. We're working in a place like Nepal, which 6 years ago was a Hindu-controlled government, and the Maoists came in and overthrew that government, established a democratic republic, and now we're able to go in and start radio stations and health clinics in a country that was formerly completely closed to the gospel. So these are amazing days we're living in today, and God has given us these amazing media tools, not only radio, but satellite and internet and social media, with which we can share Christ in some of the most formerly closed places of the world.
And of course, this all gives an underlying lesson, perhaps, to the church in the West for ourselves and the enormous amount of missions work that we have to do right here at home. I'll never forget years ago running into a group of Christians that were in China. And in the course of conversation, asked them what they felt the Lord had called them to do. And without exception, each and every one of these young college-age individuals indicated that they felt God had called them to be missionaries to the United States. What an amazing turn of events where in the 1800s here, the likes of Hudson Taylor were traveling to China to bring the gospel message. And now the very fruit of his labor, 100-and-something years later, now feels burdened to turn around and come to the United States to bring the gospel message here.
One of the things that we strive to do at Reach Beyond, and that's kind of the whole underlying theory of the book, Reach Beyond, is to call the Church of Jesus Christ in North America to a stronger commitment to reach the unreached. I was involved, as you may know, Craig, in Christian radio for many, many years in this country, until God called me to this work 6 years ago, and the verse God used was Romans 15:20, where Paul said, "It has always been my ambition to preach the gospel where the name of Christ is not known." So in our book, we have what we're calling our mission manifesto, and it's a call to action to ourselves and to the church in this country. For example, we state, "We refuse to stand idly by as people enter eternity without Christ, when we can share the good news that transforms them through the media they use. We refuse to watch people for whom Christ died suffer in pain and poverty, when we can help restore them in his name. And we say we refuse to fear the darkness that entraps people, when common sense is protect yourself and stay in your comfort zone. We put on the armor of God and storm the gates of hell for the sake of the unreached, if that's what's required."
Coming up,
how do I put the guardrails back in my life to keep this healthy? And who's controlling what? Is it controlling you, or are you controlling it?
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. The pace and the negativity of the news cycle can be, well, overwhelming. If you're like an ever-growing percentage of the population, social media in its various forms is a key source for news and information and how we sort through the news. It's not surprising that social media is leaving more and more Americans depressed. Gregory Jantz, author of Social Media and Depression, How to Be Healthy and Happy in the Digital Age, joined my colleague here in the Pacific Northwest, Tim Gatos from AM 820 The Word in Seattle.
It's in the news all the time about Facebook and Twitter and how, you know, their algorithms are working and what's becoming known about how they're essentially working against us as humans. I mean, it's frightening to see kind of behind the scenes, and we're only seeing partially what's going on. What are you seeing, Doctor?
Well, there is a lot going on. And one of the things is the information coming to us
is absolutely filtered and controlled and manipulated. No doubt about that. I think we're discovering more and more of this, and there's more to come to light. And what we know is social media can get a real stronghold in a person's life, by the way. You take kids, you take adults. But during this last few years now, pandemic or whatever we want to call this time we've been in, people have turned to the digital world. And now they've stayed in the digital world at a higher level than ever before. And so social media is where I get my news. It's where my relationships are. And social media has a way of distorting reality. So there's a lot we can talk about what's going on, but how's it affecting people? Well, there's some good parallels and correlations between social media use and how I'm using it and depression and anxiety levels.
Hmm. How do you see this? I guess on the ground level, what is the data? I'm sure there's a lot of anecdotal information, a lot of statistical information that shows this. How do you go about diagnosing this?
Right. Well, one of the things is if I'm already on the edge and maybe I've been struggling with some depression and I'm going to social media, maybe for connection, for affirmation, and there's a lot of things that can hook me in. And I can go down a lot of bunny trails, but here's what happens. I get oversaturated with too much information. And that too much information begins to kind of put me in an overwhelmed state. And there are those who have, through the time we're in, have kind of had, we'll call it a break from reality where they don't know what to believe anymore. And that's what's happening. There's a lot of confusion. And we know that there are some good studies, by the way, about depression and social media use. Mm. What we know is the more you're isolated to social media, the more, if you have a tendency already to struggle with some depression, the more that goes up.
Doctor, I wanted to ask, what do you do at the center when it comes to this whole concept of the digital side of things, the devices that are brought in by clients? And how does this work practically at the center?
Oh, sure. Good question, Tim. This is very interesting for us to deal with. We don't want people to be distracted from the work they need to be doing while they're with us. So we're a place where people come for depression, anxiety, maybe addiction, and they're with us for a while. So they're staying here. So upon admissions, we have them check in any device that has a screen. That makes it real simple. Kind of covers anything that has a screen. We're going to check it in. We put it in a safe, and it's initially for 72 hours. Now, there are those that really do have what I'll call digital addiction. They, by that third day of not getting to their device, they are irritable, heart rates up, sweaty palms, headache, etc. Because they're having kind of mild withdrawal symptoms from their technology. So there really is, I've seen it firsthand, a physiological response when I'm oversaturated and I need to detox from my technology. So we see people detox. Now, they do usually want their device back. You know, maybe we have different rules for that. Maybe on Saturday you can check it out. You need to do some things and you turn it back in. Well, the first week people do. They say, okay, yeah, I'd like to have my device on Saturday. And they check it back in. And sometimes that can be really upsetting. They get involved in something they shouldn't, and it really, you know how it can throw things off. But by week two, and I'm making some general statements, by week two, they go, you know what, I don't think I want to check out my cell phone. I'm doing fine. Hmm. And they're starting to discover something called emotional freedom. It's like, I just got untethered from it. This feels good. I'm feeling good now. I went through detox. And I'm feeling good now. And really is when I have because we all have a relationship with technology, how do I put the guardrails back in my life to keep this healthy? And who's controlling what? Is it controlling you or are you controlling it?
Coming up, anger in our nation.
If you're going to be denounced as subhuman for disagreeing with anything that stands in the form of enforced doctrine by the governing party.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Stay with us.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Political polarization, a growing coarseness in our dialogue, and anger seem to mark our nation today. We see it in the news, and we see it in our communities and even in our families. It may feel like politics is at the root of it all. But our next guest argues that politics are really the fruit of what began some time ago. I enjoyed my enlightening conversation with Peter Wood, author of the new book titled Wrath, America Enraged.
After World War II, things began to come apart, I think in two ways. One was that's when Americans really began to discover Freudian psychoanalysis, with the idea that if you repress your anger, it will come back at you in the form of neurosis. So it was more healthy mentally to let it all out. And the other was the importation from Europe after the war of existentialism and an idea that to have an authentic life, you had to be in touch with your darkest emotions and let them out. So those two things were circulating at around the same time in the early 1950s, mostly on the coastal elites, but gradually they spread throughout the rest of society. It's a long story. I won't try to tell it on this interview, but I think what you see happening is that the licensing of anger, this new form of individualism, gains ground because it proves to be such a useful tool for protest. People begin to understand that being angry empowers them and excites other people. Anger becomes something of a spectator sport, and that's one of the first places we really see it, is that sports, which used to be governed by codes of sportsmanship, suddenly become places where people swear and brawl, and it turns out to be one way in which you can make anger into something that is both more lived experience and less controlled. We saw it happening in our mass media, our movies, even in our music, and angrification takes place. I don't see now how you can create a meaningful compromise between people who want the country to have no borders and people who want the borders to be enforced, or people who believe that a woman's right to choose trumps everything, and people who think that the right to life trumps everything. Those are not matters to be settled by a handshake. We have a world right now in which the division between those who think the 2020 election was stolen and those who call that the big lie can't really even talk about it.
Each side
gets boiling mad at the other once the opposing idea is put on the table.
I wanted to ask, progressive elites are stoking rage on a range of issues, from anti-racism, critical race theory, efforts to erase American history, the 1619 Project, one example, unfettered illegal immigration, the COVID pandemic response, new voter rights comparisons. What are the risks of losing emotional self-control and the consequences of a culture that indulges too freely in the celebration of anger? And what kind of threat does that pose to the republic?
Well, that's a hefty question. I would say that all the things you're talking about are backed up with emotional rage. If you try to engage in reasoned argument with somebody who holds the positions that you just listed, you don't get reasoned argument in return. What you get is a kind of denunciation. You're a racist, you're a xenophobe, you're a homophobe, you're some kind of person whose own views are reduced to a pathological, psychological state. So what you get when you license anger to be the tool by which you proceed through disagreements with other people. Well, what you don't get is argument. What you do get is a effort to write the person out of the conversation altogether. The result of that on the political scale means that tens of millions of people are denied the right to participate in their own government. The idea of consent of the governed, which is intrinsic to our republic, disappears because the governed in this case can only be controlled or suppressed. Now, we're talking about a big range of issues. Each of those things is sort of compacted into an ideology in which the view is that social justice, or so-called social justice, lies on one side, and on the other side, there only is this category of the ignorant, the deplorable, those who gravitate towards fascist dictatorship. Terms of abuse that don't really describe what anybody believes at all. Since it's extremely difficult to find anybody who's an actual racist, we have this new concept of systemic racism, which can be applied across the board, regardless of what a person really believes or stands for. That is a kind of pollution of the world of a democratic polity. You can't really engage in politics if you're going to be denounced as subhuman for disagreeing with anything that stands in the form of enforced doctrine by the governing party. Well, I'm saying the governing party, of course, can change. And we are now in this situation where we face a government that, in my view, was elected by, let's say, mischief, actions taken that didn't fully comport with the rule of law, has brought in President Biden and Vice President Harris. They have been able to use the levers of government to advance the kinds of policies you're talking about. All that sort of thing rankles, but if you try to express it in the mainstream media in America, you will find yourself not just cut down in that act, but perhaps prohibited from appearing anywhere else. We have these incredibly powerful things like Facebook and Twitter, which seem to have a capacity to say you don't exist. If we disagree with you, we will prohibit you from expressing any views at all on our platform. And since all the platforms interlock with one another, it really creates a class of non-citizens.
Coming up, a place between giving in to anger and giving up on conviction.
I do encourage them to be thoughtfully forceful in maintaining their opinions against peer pressure.
More with Peter Wood when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. When we hear of a scholar writing on the negative impact of anger on the nation, we might conclude that we need to back down, so to speak, in our convictions, to go silent on what we really believe. However, Peter Wood argues that you can engage the angry without responding in anger. Let's listen to a few more minutes with Peter Wood, author of Wrath, America Enraged. What encouragement can you give our listeners as our time is ticking away, who recognize and will immediately recognize what you write about in the book, but want to do something different, to be constructive, to perhaps move the republic in a direction that's more more constructive and favorable to a future?
Well, I took heart from the school board elections and state elections that occurred this month, especially in Virginia, but also in New Jersey, here where I am in New York, where there was a real sign that the public is sufficiently fed up to push back against this. That's one thing. When I see people resisting, as in air traffic controllers or airline pilots, or in again in New York, it's been nurses and doctors and firefighters and policemen who have put some brakes on this. Whatever we do for a living, we have some opportunity to exert ourselves beyond just our individual choices and to influence other people. Maybe the hardest thing of all to do is to bring this into your actual community, your friends, relations, people that you go to church with. I'm in the midst of that now, and I live in a deep blue part of New York City. I'm on Upper West Side. I'm surrounded by people who strongly disagree with my every opinion. And yet I try to pick my way through that by showing people that I can disagree with them without becoming a monster. But I don't want to give up my right to dissent. And I think that that's a hard choice that we each have to make individually about where you're going to dissent and how you're going to do it. And sometimes the results are just not very nice. You lose friends, or in one of my cases, a group at church just broke up because people couldn't stand knowing, not even expressing, that others held different views. Mm. I think it's important that that kind of thing actually happen, that you don't live in fear of it happening to the point where you begin to compromise away your right to self-expression.
Yeah.
I don't encourage people to be antagonistic, but I do encourage them to be thoughtfully forceful in maintaining their opinions against peer pressure.
Thank you for joining us for The Christian Outlook. There's more to my conversation with Peter Wood, and you can hear the full interview at ChristianOutlook.com. While you're at our site, remember to subscribe to our podcast. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Mike Cook, Alex Perez, and James Blend, I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook. But it flew away from her reach, so she ran away in her sleep.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.